grower panel, so you'll get to see them again. But if y'all want to go ahead and come up, Dr. Galen Morgan is going to be our moderator for the session, and I'll let him introduce the producers individually.
Thanks, Lori. It's a pleasure to be here today and to be a part of this panel. I just started with Cotton Incorporated back in June. I came from an extension cotton agronomist position where my focus was fairly narrow. So working with this group, with sustainability group, has really broadened my perspective on, you know, what's important in cotton, and maybe more importantly that, you know, it's not just about growing cotton. We have to have a market for the cotton. And this Fieldprint calculator and Cotton Trust Protocol are a way to enhance that market opportunities. And we're fortunate to have some very progressive farmers up here today and others involved in the industry that have been working in this area of sustainability and to provide their perspective on things. So again, start with Ted Snyder. Ted's a farmer in northeast Louisiana and southeast Arkansas. He farms cotton, corn, rice, wheat, sorghum. Has been involved in all aspects of sustainability on his farm since 1984 when he started farming, and he's currently chair of the National Cotton Council Sustainability Task Force. And there'll be a little introductions of themselves in a little bit, so I'm keeping this brief. Then we have Keelan Lee, farms corn, sorghum, and cotton, obviously, in eastern Louisiana. Got an agronomy degree at Mississippi State, and then he's currently participating in the pilot project, which was introduced here in Andy Jordan's film, and working with the Fieldprint calculator. And then on your far right, we have Jeff Peters. He's a senior manager of sustainability for Nutrient Ag Solutions. He's worked in the ag industry for 26 years in various roles, and he's currently working to develop and implement sustainability programs for the ag supply chain. So again, a good diverse set of panelists up here. And we'll go ahead and do a general introductions. They can do some level of introduction themselves of things that I've overlooked, but in the same time also get their perspective and definition of what sustainability is. So, Ted, if you want to kick it off.
Okay, thank you. As Galen said, I am from Louisiana. I am the chairman of the Sustainability Task Force. So I've had several years of experience in dealing with sustainability. The definition of sustainability that we use, as I said on the film, it's the ability of the present generation to meet their own needs without compromising the ability of future generations to meet theirs. When I translate that into what it means to me personally, I'm a third-generation farmer. There were two generations ahead of me who left me a very nice farm to work with. Now, I've got the responsibility of having two generations below me, and sustainability, the definition of sustainability fits perfectly. I've experienced it from on the receiving end, and now it's time for me to give back to generations behind me.
Certainly, I couldn't say it much better than that as well. My name's Kellen Lee, I'm fourth-generation farmer in Louisiana as well, and just like Mr. Ted said, it's, staying in the business and being good stewards of your land, being productive, all that is sustainable to me, and, making sure that I can carry our operation to the next generation. That's the goal.
So, good morning, and first I want to thank Cotton Inc. and National Cotton Council for inviting me to speak here today, and just share some of my insights and experience. I have been in the ag industry now 26 years, and it's funny how time flies. 22 years were spent with Syngenta. I have a lot of environmental fate background. I've worked in sustainability for 10 years and actually alongside Andy on a lot of the projects over the years. The last 3.5 years were spent with Agrible. It was a digital startup company, where we're still seeing oversight of projects and programs with the supply chain. One of the programs that we're supporting right now is the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol. We are working in the Panhandle area of Texas, so we'll be able to share a bit more insight on that. Sustainability is kind of like an elephant. You don't know which end of it you're getting and what part. Is it the tail? Is it the leg? What part of sustainability are you talking about? So when we talk about sustainability, in my mind, it's more about survivability and out of necessity. So if we look at market conditions and we look at weather conditions right now, growers are having to respond to this through efficiencies. And a lot of these efficiencies that we're talking about, whether it's natural resource management or how you're managing your inputs or your time and your labor, all of that adds up. There's one comment that we haven't really talked about today, but it has to be also economically viable for the producer. The numbers have to pencil out. Otherwise, you're going to have a tough road to hoe getting there on sustainability.
So we have kind of a general list of questions that we're going to go through, and then later on we'll take questions from the audience. But some general questions. We'll start with you, Ted. The cotton industry has been a leader in sustainability and is recognized for that. It was mentioned in one of the earlier presentations. How has the cotton being that leader in sustainability, how has it affected you and your farm and your operation over the many years of farming?
As a leader in the sustainability task force, actually goes back about 5 years. I've been really highly involved with Cotton Council International, which is our international promotion arm for the cotton industry. And one of my roles with them was to travel and to make presentations to our customers, the supply chain, brands and retailers, and textile industry people. And that was as a producer, to introduce myself as a producer. U.S. cotton is grown primarily by family farmers like me. We're not perceived that way in a lot of circles. Also, it was to show how we grow cotton. One of the slides that I use in my presentation is to show 35 years of improvement that the cotton industry has made in cotton production. We've got really good metrics in sustainability over the 35-year period. Gary said it earlier today. We were practicing sustainability before the term sustainability was ever attributed to these practices. In my case, 35 years ago is when I left a 3-year career in banking and returned to the family farm. We were agriculture across the entire country was leaving very abruptly an economic boom, moving into a very abrupt depression. And if you didn't adapt and change and start limiting resources, doing everything you could to be efficient and produce more with less, you went out of business. And there were a lot of really good farmers in the 80s who went out of business. And so that was the atmosphere that I came into agriculture. And that atmosphere, because cotton farming is not something you can jump in and out of, it's a generational thing. You use different equipment for harvest, processing. Cotton farmers tend to be generational. If you didn't go through that, Kellen probably didn't. Your dad did. And so you've got that mindset of continual improvement, which you'll hear a lot connected to sustainability. And it has to do with, as Jeff said, economic survival. So we were practicing sustainability. We just didn't really know it at the time. But there are three legs to sustainability: environmental sustainability, which we all think is that; social sustainability, which is treating your workers, your community, and your neighbors correctly; and economic sustainability. If you don't have all three of those, you're not sustainable. So we practice economic sustainability, which goes directly into environmental sustainability.
Keelan or Jeff, or Kellen or Jeff, you guys want to add to that? Or
I would just agree with Ted. For the U.S. cotton producer today, if they weren't sustainable, they wouldn't be around. So I think that's a given. I do think where the gap is at, and which Ken and Jesse talked about this morning, though, we need to be able to document that and quantify that and communicate that story. Communicating the story is the missing piece right now. So we need that information. We need producers engaging on this topic.
Yeah, exactly. So I think where we're using field to market, things like that, we can exactly what he's saying. There's a gap of what we're doing is sustainable. We have been. If you're in business, you're being conservative. You know, taking care of your land. We're using this as proof. We need to connect this to the brands and retailers.
All right. The next question is probably directed more toward you, Jeff. With Agrible and data management systems, you've been working with to help growers for many years, making farming and sustainable farming decisions. How has that landscape changed over the past decade? And then to follow up on that, what is your vision for the next decade on how data management is going to be integrated in a sustainability system?
Yeah. I guess first, who wrote that question? Because are you picking on me because I'm the old guy?
No comment.
Yeah, 10 years have come and gone pretty quick. And, you know, I look back and I want to talk about first as a starting point, digital tools and technology are part of the solution. You know, when we talk about sustainability, we're really talking about agronomy. So it's agronomy combined with digital tools and all the other aspects of it. So it's sort of a systems level approach that we're referring to here. One of the things, looking back retrospectively at, you know, some of the earlier projects we used, Fieldprint Platform, one of the tools that I've seen that has really accelerated the adoption of digital technology, everyone sitting in the room right now has one on them, I guarantee you. It's a phone. This right here. Mobile devices have given us anytime, anywhere access. And moving from a role with a manufacturer over to a startup company, it was so evident to see how things were changing. When we have workshops now with producers and others, they'll break out their phones, they'll use their iPads, and off they go. So I think this vehicle has really enabled digital the past 10 years. When we talk about some of the digital tools, we kind of have to break them down into categories. There's farm management software, and there are a lot of systems out there right now. But what we've seen over the past 10 years is that now they have been able to understand the business case of integrating sustainability into their platforms. That's a big deal. Because growers are asking for one platform to do their data entry and their record keeping and everything else that they're doing in their business. So it's one of convenience for the producer. We have seen great improvement on that within Field to Market and a number of QDMP partners that are part of Field to Market now. The second part would probably be around precision ag. Precision ag comes in a lot of different forms, but if we're talking about variable rate and variable rate fertilizer application, there's been broad adoption of that in the past 10 years. And that's across all commodities. Variable rate irrigation and the projects that I've worked on the past years, and right now we've got about 15 projects running in the U.S. I would say there's still a learning and evaluation phase going on. You know, there's variable rate irrigation, then there's subsurface drip, there's LISA, and there's LIPA systems. And growers are utilizing those, but they're trying to understand what's the break even and what's the ROI mean to their operation. So I think that's a critical point as well. When we look at predictive analytics, and that's really where Agrible's sweet spot has been the last few years, it's getting the right information at the right time to make the right decision. What we do is we take crop modeling and weather and management information to provide actionable insights back to producers. And to Ted's point earlier, you know, we're not prescriptive whatsoever, and Andy also said it. We're going to provide insight and intel, but it's up to the grower to understand what fits for their operation. Agriculture is not cut, copy, paste. So a lot of these technologies, they may apply in some geographies and some crops, and others it may not be a fit. So it's understanding that aspect of it. From the predictive analytics, though, timing of applications and some of the tools that we see growers quickly migrating to. Spraying applications to mitigate spray drift, field workability applications based on weather. We have a lot of applications that are based on weather. And if you think about it from a grower perspective, you know, there's a lot of things they can control. There's a lot of things they can't control. Commodity prices is one thing they can't control. But, guys, what's the one thing a grower can't control but it's something they're fighting every year? It's the weather, right? So growers want more weather intel. They are making costly decisions every day. And the more information that you can provide that's going to support them on that, it's going to build confidence. So we see a lot of that. In terms of, you know, what does the next 10 years look like? Wow, that's a crystal ball question right there. You know, I can see a lot of transformation happening, and I can see that, you know, we're going to take some of the guesswork out of farming. A lot of it's instinct right now, over generations. One of the things that comes to mind first are sensors. There's a lot of soil sensor technology out there on moisture, but we're going to see the evolution of that. I think there's going to be a change there. I think machine learning, predictive analytics, we've just scratched the surface of where that's going to go. Robotics, I see that falling in the precision ag category. RFID, blockchain technology, I see that there's going to be a movement in that space. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Gartner hype curve. Does anybody understand what that is? Okay, I got one here. So Gartner hype curve, especially for technology, there's a great expectation, and it goes through the roof. And then there's this realization that, you know, there's a lot to be worked out. And then there's a period of enlightenment. And then finally, it's where you become productive. So I think a lot of these technologies, we've got to go through that evolution to understand where it's going to really play in the future. And I guess finally, the other opportunity I see would be with satellite imagery and drones. What's old is new again. And I still think the cost is going to come down. I think the frequency of having that information and intel is going to increase. And the utility of that in the farm operation is going to grow.
Ted or Kellen, you guys have anything to add to that one?
I'll say this. I agree with Jeff. We do need better weather, man. like this, I'm not staying in this hotel. And this morning I walked out to what was supposed to be a sunny day, and it drizzled on me the whole way. So that happens quite often on the farm. And the other thing, as far as precision agriculture goes, where it fits with sustainability, is necessity is a mother of invention. And because we don't control the price that we receive, we produce a bulk commodity. We don't, from year to year and even day to day in a lot of cases, we can't really control our income. We can control, to a certain degree, our input costs. And precision agriculture is allowing us to reduce costs tremendously, and that really fits in the sustainability narrative.
And to go along with precision ag too, it's a lot of organization comes along with that too. You get a lot more precise, you know, per acre on what you're applying or how you applied it, you know, if there's any waste or where there isn't any waste. But being more organized and along those lines, that helps a lot too.
Yeah, it's amazing, guys, as we help producers on sustainability, sort of like the video with Andy there helping. You know, the adoption of FMS is probably farm management software, record keeping is not as great as you might expect. I would say maybe 25% of producers right now are using an FMS type system. So that means 75% of them are still pen and paper or Excel. And you wouldn't believe it, but when you get out there, you realize that's still where we're at. So there's a lot of room to grow and improve on that aspect of it.
Kind of following along those lines, I mean, with these innovations in technology and adoption of this technology, Ted, you and Kellen, could you provide some examples of how you specifically used either field print calculator or these data management tools on your farm?
Yeah, I'll take it. I like to use my own farm as an example. I've been involved in field to market for three crops now, and I'm actually working for Dr. Jordan, and been this pilot project, and I can see all the growers have a ID number that's anonymous to me, but I can see where they stand as far as their data, or as far as their imprint, their print is, their field print. And the first thing that I saw was my ID number, which I know is mine. I don't know anyone else's, but it was the worst one. And so using field to market, you know, using that data, being able to see that, made some adjustments pretty quickly, and that, you know, was pretty beneficial as far as that goes. But it allows us to be able to compare to state benchmarks and national benchmarks as well. So from a producer standpoint, you know, being eye opening like that, just immediately being able to see where you stand as far as as benchmark averages, you know, that's the closest. And from you know, brands and retailers, being able to tell your story using this data, you know, as Mr. Jeff said, we're not, you know, as of before now, we haven't been doing a too good a job of telling our story, and this is exactly what we can use this data and this data tool to do.
Yeah, I agree with Kellen. It's a motivator. You know, I'm like a lot of producers, I think I'm doing about as well as I can. And then you input all your data into the field print calculator, and it spits out that spider gram that shows your footprint. And there's always areas that you can improve. And if I'm out of whack in one of the metrics, then it makes me wonder why and what I can do different. And there's, you know, there's data tools that go on your tractors. I used to use one precision planting tool that would, if you input the price of seed, it would tell you how much your mistake was costing you on the go. And it was pretty interesting. Sometimes when it got up there, you'd slam on the brakes and decide to figure out what was wrong. So all of those tools are available to us, and they really help us become more sustainable.
So along those lines, do any of you guys just plug in like different scenarios, knowing that's there? Say you were in conventional tillage, and you plug in conservation tillage just to see how it's going to change your potential before you adopt. So I mean, it could save you lots of money in that regard as well.
Certainly, field to market is pretty unique in that sense. Once you've entered in your practices, you get to the final part where it gives you a spidergram. You kind of see where you stand. There's all sorts of different scenarios, different tillage practices. A big thing on our operation has been winter cover crops, but you can go back and you can change those scenarios and go through it and analyze that, and it'll adjust it and show you how much it improves you. Well, you haven't done anything, you know, spend any money or time or anything as far as that goes, and it'll tell you pretty accurately how that'll benefit you. So that's pretty unique.
Kellen just exposed the difference between us. He's far more technologically savvy than I am, and I'm not quite sure how to do that, so I just have to do the old-fashioned method and just guess.
Another question that's come up from, you know, most of us in the ag industry are pretty independent, and we don't necessarily like people telling us what to do. So, I mean, how do you guys perceive the pressure from the consumer and or retailers telling you that, oh, you need to be more sustainable if you're going to have a market out there? Oh, and by the way, we're not going to pay you for it. So, I mean, how do you guys deal with that, and how could you explain to growers or anyone else in this industry, you know, why get into it kind of thing?
Well, I think this protocol and the whole sustainability arena is an opportunity. And that's to communicate better with the supply chain and consumers. You know, I probably spend too much time on the internet seeing what activists and other people who don't like what we're doing say about us. And, you know, a lot of younger people especially get their news from social media, and they don't know us anymore. They don't know farmers anymore. This gives us a real opportunity to connect with our supply chain and with the consumer in a much more productive and positive way. We've got to take control of the narrative in our industry. We've let others define us for too long. You know, so many people when I do presentations are just really surprised when I show pictures of my farm, the wildlife on it, my grandkids who could be considered wildlife probably, my children. They're really surprised because we're not perceived that way. But cotton is, again, primarily grown by families, and we need to make sure that our supply chain and consumers know it's, you know your farmer has gotten to be a slogan, and I think that this is a great opportunity for people to know their farmer.
I don't think the interest from the consumers of what they're purchasing, you know, where that's coming from, or their interest in how it's made, their products, or anything like that. And with that, you know, it's kind of put a little bit of pressure or opened up my mind to, instead of, you know, I live in a very small community, I have, you know, a little farm there, you know, and instead of just worrying about that crop and getting to the next year or focusing on just what we're doing, it's kind of brought on more of a broad, you know, this is impacting more of the market, you know, instead of just my one little niche, you know. And so, for example, if there's a, you know, one field that's doing very poorly on production, or there's a lot of, you know, washouts or soil loss, things like that, you know, it may be a small thing on our entire operation, but it could make a big difference in the story, you know. And being able to look at things like that, taking that into consideration is important.
I would just kind of add to what Ted and Kellen have said is that, you know, guys, it's really, really important to be at the table shaping this topic, because this is not a fad. This trend is growing. And Jesse talked about some of the science-based targets that companies have in the next 10 years. And these are real. You know, these are real targets there. So it is important to be part of the conversation and to provide feedback and direction and guidance on that.
Very good. I guess one of the other things that I'm hearing is, you know, concerns. Just there are some concerns out there, whether it's a cotton trust protocol or others. But what, as farmers and the other industry, concerns do you guys have, and how have you reconciled those concerns that you could relay to the audience of how they've overcome, or what needs to be fixed if there are concerns, what needs to be done in the cotton trust protocol or sustainability as a whole to address as an industry?
Well, the main concern is being on the task force, we had several concerns. We had to produce a protocol that worked for all stakeholders. If we couldn't get producer participation, we didn't have a protocol. If brands and retailers and NGOs and other organizations didn't accept what we came up with, we didn't have a protocol. Our organization now, as Ken laid out, we have NGOs, we've got brands and retailers, we have producer interests. Any stakeholder who has anything to do with cotton is on that task force. I think my biggest concern is that, you know, a producer, when he thinks about value, what's he going to get for participating? Thinks about it in how many cents per pound extra he's going to get for cotton. That's not going to be the case here. We've got to convince a producer that there is value to participation over and above a cent or two a pound. It's going to force him to really look at his operation, try to keep doing what he's doing, continually improving. And the cotton industry's long-term profitability and survival is going to be on increasing demand. And our supply chain is demanding this. We have to respond because there are other countries in the world that grow cotton. There are other sources. There are other fiber choices. We've got to stay in the forefront. We've got to be able to convince producers to participate.
One of the concerns I've heard maybe come up a couple of times is probably pertain to the verification side of it. And the main point I make about that, whenever I have heard it, is, you know, anything you are doing, as long as, you know, what the assessment has brought on is not, you know, going to bring on anything that you need to be criminalized, you know, or in trouble about or anything like that. But the verification part is I guess, what brings a little bit of concern to some of the producers that I've talked to about it. And with any of that, this brings on a little bit of discomfort, but it's the way the process is going to have to work.
I would just say, you know, be very, very clear in your communication with producers. What's the ask? What's the need? What's in it for me? And you got to speak farmer. We got to take this back to agronomy. A lot of the terminology at an industry level and some of the committees that we sit on are so far removed from, you know, the farmer that they don't understand, they don't comprehend. So we have to distill those messages down.
Well, and I think along the lines of agronomy, too, I mean, as we perpetually increase yield through better genetics and more efficiency, that makes our more sustainability as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I got through the prepared list of questions. I'd like to open it up to the audience. Anyone have questions, concerns, things like that associated with sustainability, cotton trust protocol, field print calculator that this group can try to address? Yes.
The question was what specifically what cover crops do we use? We use winter wheat and there's some winter peas. There's a lot of different options depending on what area you grow, but we're just using winter wheat.
My choices depend on the crop that is going to follow that cover crop. I've grown a lot of cereal rye in the past. This year I have radishes and Austrian winter peas planted, and that's for building organic matter and hopefully getting a little nitrogen out of the winter peas.
I would just add that we see a lot of the West Texas growers using winter wheat as well, just to reduce wind erosion.
Any other questions from the audience?
So, Gabe.
Yeah, James.
You know, the last comment was that, you know, there are other sources if we don't step up. Now, I assume that we heard the other day, and I was here, you know, if you're an American producer and you're obeying the law, you're up in the top decile of what buyers want, whatever. How long do we have, do you think, until all those other sources start bumping up against us and that brands and buyers actually begin to say, oh, I've got 10 sources of sustainable cotton? Because there probably isn't that much available now globally. Is that true? What other countries are doing that? And how fast are they rising?
Well, the I wouldn't say it's our biggest competitor, but BCI, the Better Cotton Initiative, has a lot of cotton out there. They've been around for quite a while. They created a model that works. you'd be surprised that the U.S. cotton is not on the approved list of a lot of major brands and retailers. And that's, you know, Jesse said, you know, they're looking for program cotton. We don't have the program right now. Once we get that established, we've gotten really good feedback from brands and retailers that they will accept us. I think we got put on the approved list of Walmart recently. But we've got a ways to go in creating the program and getting the program will get us on approved list. But we will start to lose market share. There are a lot of companies that have put, you know, 2020 up to 2025 to buy sustainable or program cotton.
Yeah, Tina.
Mr. Lee, could you tell us the specific changes that you made after you saw that to improve your field print calculator spidergram?
Certainly. The question was what changes did I make? We weren't doing very much cover crop work before that, and that makes a tremendous difference on your soil loss. We have a lot of rain where we farm, especially during the wintertime, and it brings on a lot of erosion. And another, you know, second front runner is tillage, you know, so we kind of try to make some adjustments on cutting back on how many times we till the ground up and maybe just do a re-hip instead of a double disc and a re-hip or, you know, things like that. But, and, you know, paying attention to our fertilizer use is a big one, which, you know, the part of being a sustainable operation, you know, economically, there's not very many growers that are over-applying fertilizers because it costs too much, you know. But if there's the universities do a really good job of showing us exactly what a crop specifically needs, you know, and we can see how much we leach, you know, we're going to lose throughout a growing season, so we can be a lot more specific on how much fertilizer we use with that kind of information.
So, Ted, to be in a program, what percentage of producers need to be involved? I'm just wondering, I'm a cotton producer, so I'm sitting here thinking, you know, there's not really a reward for me, but the reward for the industry, which will affect me personally. So how many do we have to get in the program?
You know, that's a subjective question, and we've asked brands and retailers that, and they all have a different answer because, you know, sustainability is an evolving process, and what's important to Levi might not be so important to Walmart. They just want a representative sample. You know, we're shooting for 750 to 1,000 producers this year, and it, you know, hopefully, eventually, we'll have a solid answer to that question. We want as many as possible.
One last question.
It seems like a game. I mean, it seems like there's a game going on. I'm just thinking about how this works. But we're not playing right now, is what it seems like. So you're saying
well,
gotta get in,
it's not a game. It's serious business. No, and I agree with what you're saying. I think that what's going to set us apart is our data. We've got a certain level of traceability that we can produce. We've got rules and regulations that we grow cotton under that most other countries don't. We have a tremendous support system with public and private research, unlike any other country. That's incredibly important to us going forward. We've got a lot of positives, and I think once we get our program, we can tell that story. But no, it's serious business.
Yeah, from a global perspective to the previous question, it kind of feeds into what you're saying, Bill, is with the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol, it's about credibility and verification, and that's going to be there for years to come.
Clay, do you have a question?
Sustainability Why are they tagging it to a specific farmer? And a lot of language has been used like force or push or convince or... Why not just prove what we're already doing and be happy with that until the market demands more?
Well, that's what the data will do, is prove. What's important is, supplying that data and making it available to the supply chain. I think it's, we do everything that we can to reduce input costs. Margins across the entire supply chain of the apparel industry are very tight. And from top to bottom, we all need to be aware of, reducing costs. We just have to, this is what our customers are asking for, and we have to be able to supply that. There are some brands here if they'd like to try to answer that question too. I won't put anybody on the spot. I won't even look at anybody.
As a producer, I can relate, but it's not just on our shoulders either, I don't think. Seed companies, breeders, the better the yield gets and we keep our practices like we are doing, just like you said, or improve at least some and the yield gets better, then our efficiency is better. So that will, go along with how our metrics get better over time as well.
Well, and sustainability is not an end point. It's going to continue, to improve, right? So it's always raising the bar. That bar will continue to raise over time.
All right. I think that concludes our session. I appreciate everyone participating. And probably some of the panelists will be around if you have specific questions and would like to visit with them or me. Be glad to do so. Thank you.
All right, we're running a little bit behind, but we're going to go ahead and jump right into our brand and retail panel. Moderating that one will be Jesse Daystar from Cotton Incorporated, and I'll let him introduce the panelists.
Great. Well, what a good panel and some great questions from the crowd. Really appreciate those, and I hope to keep those going throughout this session as well. So you've kind of heard kind of the industry's take on where the brands and where the consumers and where we think it's going, but now we hope to really hear from those individuals sitting up here who are in that, who have been in that realm, and are working in that space directly from them, because I think they all have different unique experiences and insights to draw from. So we have, I'll let them introduce in more detail, but we have Liza Schiller from Levi's, Steve Dyer from Louis Dreyfus, and Gary Bell, formerly with Gildan and also with, what's your new company's name?
Chasing Better
Consulting. So I'll let y'all introduce yourselves.
Thanks, Jesse, and I'm very excited to be here and to be talking to you all and listening to the questions. It sounds like we've got a really great audience. I'm excited to hear your questions. But my name's Liza Shiloh. I have been with Levi Strauss for 5 years. I am our senior manager of sustainability integration, and so I oversee a couple things, our climate change strategy, our sustainable fiber strategy. Those two intersect quite a bit, and I spend a lot of time there. And so I've played a growing role within our company on our positioning for sustainable cottons. So that's how I'm here and engaged in the conversation today.
All right, thanks, Jesse. I'm Steve Dyer with Louis Dreyfus. I'm global head of marketing for the Dreyfus Cotton Platform. I'm also head of our cooperative called ProCot. There was a lot of questions that were asked back there that I wanted to stand up and take myself. But hopefully we'll get asked again. You know, this this sustainability thing for us has been going on for a number of years. I'll say, you know, 4, 5, 6 plus years. The definitions are quite broad. I mean, I think that's putting it loosely. Us as merchants, we do have, you know, us, Dreyfus especially, have the ability to trade other world origins. We know what's going on in the rest of the world. We know what we have to do here in the U.S. It's not an easy task. I don't think anybody thought it was going to be. But that's why we're here. You know, it's, you know, baby steps. You know, we're going to crawl before we walk and run. So I'm excited about sharing my experience and kind of what we've done in past. And you know, again, I'm not shy about questions. So you guys ask or, you know, come find me after. Thanks.
Good afternoon, or good, yeah, I guess good morning, everyone. I'm an optimist, so I'll start off by saying that. I don't think sustainability for anyone in this room or anybody in this industry should be an issue and seen as an issue, should see it as an opportunity. I had the good fortune of working for the last 24 years until recently with a company named Gildan that's essentially the single biggest domestic consumer of U.S. cotton. Probably one out of every 3 bales of U.S. cotton that's consumed here is in fact consumed by that company. And over the years with Gildan, a very entrepreneurial company, I had an opportunity to touch on an awful lot of parts of the business, from product development and marketing, sustainability, and how sustainability basically permeates throughout the entire organization, as it should within, and it already does, within almost every single one of your farms. Farmers by default are sustainability experts. You have been, your grandfathers and great-grandfathers have been, because it really boils down to getting more with less. So treating every single drop of water, every kilowatt of energy, every single drop of oil, every single liter of gasoline or gallon of gasoline as a precious resource that needs to be maximized, and treating waste as something that's just evil. And that's at the heart of it. That's essentially what sustainability is. It's not complicated. It seems to be complicated. People have really complicated ways of looking at it. The reality is it's a tremendous opportunity. And I look forward to fielding some of the questions as well. I think Steve and I were both chomping at the bit with some of the questions that happened earlier.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. Yeah, I as well. There's a lot of great questions that Ted and others all did a great job answering, but I'm glad that we have our chance now. And I'd like to also mention that everybody here on stage, is, including myself, is involved in the Cotton Trust Protocol either as an advisor or as actually a board member. So not only do they have the industry experience, but also now they've kind of looked underneath the hood and are actively engaged in creating what we're doing here. So to kick off some of the prepared questions, I spoke a lot about lists and kind of PR and the perception of industry. Maybe kick this off with Liza, if that's all right. You know, there's been times when perhaps Levi's wasn't at the top of their game, and they've come a long ways and done a lot of great things. What's that progression look like to you? What was some of the pressures that maybe got y'all going? And how has that really looked for you over the past few years?
That's a good question, because Levi's, we're such an old company, and we're grounded in, you know, the values of a family, the Strauss family, that was very community-minded, and so it's built into the company ethos to kind of be thinking about what it means to be a corporate citizen. And so our sustainability team is several decades old. I think when the conversations around labor issues overseas got going in the early 90s, that's when Levi's really started to formalize a program. And so we began our work in social and labor rights, and our programs continue to center around the social labor aspects. But we have since grown into a program that really focuses on 4 key impact areas. That's climate change, chemical usage, water usage, and people. And so that's where we channel our energy. And we were born of the supply chain, but now we're touching all parts of the business. And so I spend a lot of my days talking to the marketing team, and then talking to our product developers. And then, you know, we're pretty broad reaching today.
Great. Either one of y'all want to talk about some of the pressures that has the big asks, and kind of how your industry, your business, or broadly has responded?
Thanks, Gary. You know, for us, just speaking for Dreyfus in general, we, you know, not only do we trade cotton, but we trade coffee, sugar, corn, soybeans, wheat, multitude of agricultural products. So the sustainability is not new because food came first before fiber. But as far as cotton goes, like I was saying before, we've noticed that there's a huge push. And again, you know, the definition is very broad. I think going back 5 or 6 years, I think a lot of companies, not the Gilda or Levi's, were sort of, I'll take what I can get. Like, you call it sustainable, I'll take it. And honestly, that was a bad way forward because it taught everybody just to take whatever alternative they can, just to put their stamp or their seal or whatever on it. The world really didn't know anything besides BCI for a number of years. It was the only workable alternative. We had to do it. We made it work. I know there's plenty of grumblings across, the U.S. farmers. You know, why do I have to fill this thing out? And I always said, you know, for the BCI questionnaire, which is bizarre, has asked some weird questions. You could put, do I comply with all U.S. laws and regulations on my farm? Check. And that's 75% of what you need to fill out. So it's no secret that, you know, all the U.S. growers are, you know, they comply with all these standards. But we didn't know anything besides BCI, so we had to do it. We had to provide it for our customers. It was the only alternative. Now we've got the protocol, which, you know, personally I think is going to work a lot better. It's just education, adaptability by the global marketplace, and it's going to be an uphill battle, but again, it's one I think we can win.
Jesse, I'd just add that I think this pressure from sustainability have gone through a journey of their own. So as Liza was saying, you know, it initiated almost every company that's actually involved, a brand or retailer that has a set sustainability program today, probably was launched into it either in the crisis or someone was fearful of a crisis happening. And in all likelihood, it started on the labor front, labor and social front. And the stakeholders that all brands and retailers have evolved, and they're becoming a lot more demanding. You know, we touched on numerous of those stakeholders, employees, recruits. So in a really tight job market, recruiting new employees to your company, if you don't have stated values and goals and sustainability targets that align with that individual's own goals, you might not actually be able to hire them. You know, the other stakeholder, which we've seen a really rise in the importance of having clearly defined sustainability targets, goals, and reporting, is from the investor side. So some of the companies I've worked for were publicly traded. So some of the questions from investors 5 years ago might have been, do you do a sustainability report? Now the questionnaires are coming in, and they might be 25 pages long, where they're saying, what exactly were your carbon emissions and what do you have in place to meet your target of reducing it by 10%? And they're asking a lot more pointed questions. And for those investment managers, as for a farmer, they understand that it means mitigating risk. If you have a plan in place and you have something in place that's going to allow you to mitigate risk going into a changing climate into the future, that's a sounder investment for them. So the world is changing, and I think that the sustainability protocol basically gives us that opportunity as an industry to be able to put the best foot forward and to help brands and retailers in the supply chain and your partners essentially achieve their goals.
That's some great insight. And I've been working in the cotton industry in this field for about getting on 5 years now, and I can say over the past 5 years, it's really changed. And there are a few leaders, Levi's being one of them, who are really pushing for just more sustainable cotton. But now it's who isn't doing that is the question, because the investors and the industry, you know, they're looking at that. So it's definitely a changing environment, and we're there now in a lot of ways in terms of commitments. So we've talked about some of the asks. You know, there's a lot of asks, and there's more asks than we can even accomplish. So, you know, we have to be focused about what problems are we solving, which ones are meaningful, and which ones can wait, and which ones we need to do now. That's certainly a challenge within the industry. But, you know, how has your business responded to those asks? You know, what have you put in place? And is it a business decision that, you know, makes profit? Is it a cost? or is it a competitive advantage? It could probably be all of those, but could you explain a little bit about that? Either of y'all can start it off. Yeah.
I can take a crack at it. Look, I think it really depends on where the individual brand or retailer is in their journey, in their sustainability journey, and I think it was Jeff earlier or Ted who might have said that, you know, the sustainability is not an end target. There is no end to this road, essentially. It's a road that everyone's going to be on as citizens of the planet, to be quite frank. For the most part, when you're in a manufacturing environment or when you're on a farm, if there's a sustainable practice that you can adopt, the likelihood is it's going to make you more profitable. The true definition of the triple bottom line, having that economic component, means that in hard times, those practices you're still going to continue to do. If they don't deliver an economic value, then essentially those are the ones that are going to get dropped when things get tight. So, you know, the notion of continuous improvement and the notion at the heart of all sustainability programs is this notion that yesterday wasn't good enough. You have to keep doing more. There's always one drop to save. There's always one kilowatt to save. You know, this room, if you could take that chandelier in the middle and have 20% less lights, this hotel would be reducing its environmental footprint and saving money. And I don't think anyone in the room would mind if there was 20% less lights in the middle of that chandelier. So that's just a small thing. But cumulatively, sustainability is about a lot of small practices that add up to a really big impact.
From the trading side, you know, merchant co-op side, we're worried about market share. And I know, we talked a little bit about that. We want people to choose U.S. cotton. Dreyfus, we can trade, you know, different growths, but we want people to trade and choose U.S. cotton. I'll use the poor analogy of the Coke and Cola and Kleenex and tissue. You go to the grocery store, and what are you going to choose? You're going to choose the brand you're most familiar with. You know, we want people to choose the U.S. cotton. But we don't want to disadvantage ourselves. You know, we've got to make it so it's got the sustainable brand. And it's really education. I think at the end of the day, we're providing them a solution with this protocol, and we're educating them on why they want to choose U.S. cotton. The marketplace is hard enough. We don't want people to have an easy alternative. We want them to buy U.S. cotton. So that's really our drive from the merchant and co-op side.
Yeah, I would say we are finding, you know, and you guys have already hit on this, but the consumer is becoming more and more savvy. The investor is becoming more savvy. Like, we are having to answer questions we had the luxury of not having to address before, you know, down to the specifics of where is your biggest carbon footprint across your supply chain. Like, even if we're not directly responsible for it, we kind of are. Like, it comes back to our name. And so, you know, what are the plans that we have in place? I think what's helping us a lot is getting more data. I think that's where I see a real strength of the U.S. Cotton Protocol, is that we will have that information we can point to and say, look, we're having an impact, and this is what we're behind. Because, you know, for a while it kind of had been the Wild West. Steve, you sort of hit on this, like, there, you know, as long as it says sustainability, but that's not acceptable anymore. And a lot of our peers in the industry are getting hit for that, for putting out very broad advertisements that suggest sustainability, but what does that mean anymore? And so we're being asked for more and more clarity and to adhere to specific standards and to continue raising that bar and looking for those opportunities. So Levi's is fortunately taking that angle to continue to push the boundaries and help encourage our industry to move that direction. But it's a lot of work, and, you know, it's not always a direct payback for us. It is an investment that our company is making, and in some cases we're making our suppliers, asking our suppliers to make investments with us. But, you know, when we have our CEO and our CFO getting up on national television and talking about these sustainability programs, that's a huge signal that, you know, it's a business prerogative. It's a license for us to operate. Sustainability is becoming a license to operate.
That's some great insights. I mean, you just have to do it, and I think when you do it, sometimes you do find those cost savings too. So it's twofold at least. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, back to the kind of the what is sustainable. I mean, at Cotton Incorporated, I cannot buy we are overseen by the USDA. I cannot say it is sustainable. Something is sustainable personally in a public way because that definition is so vague. And we are overseen by the organization. It's got to be grounded in good science. And the question earlier to, like, you know, why continually improve? Well, what was sustainable today when we add one more person to this world? We need, you know, two more pairs of genes. You know, how many people are born every second? So the carrying capacity and what we're doing today, literally a second from now, we got to get better because there's more people, more mouths to feed, more genes to need to be made. So there's, you know, staying still is not an option. We got to continually get better. So that's something that I'd also like to point out. Great discussion. Next question would be one of my favorites that I kind of kick it off as. And I think Liza might be a good jumping in point. So Levi's is a pretty cotton-heavy brand. We really appreciate that and your support for the cotton industry. But, you know, given the light of all the microplastics, synthetic microfiber issues that I mentioned earlier about how we eat a credit card of plastic every week, in large part from the clothing, the polyester we wash down our drains, you know, how can cotton be a sustainable fabric and be a solution to some of the industry problems surrounding fibers and more broadly? How can cotton be a solution to sustainability when you're in your business and the rest of y'all's?
Definitely. And I was actually in the presentation where they shared that statistic. They also told us that in every pint of beer, you drink four pieces of plastic. Bummed about that. I think bottled water is 5 pieces, so you're doing better with the beer.
Ted's doing dry January, so he's cutting out his plastic.
Cotton, the thing I feel is not getting talked about enough is that cotton, unlike its synthetic competitors, has the ability to be a positive impact fiber. Like, it already is a positive impact fiber, depending on the way that you're growing it, right? And I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but these concepts of regenerative agriculture in which you're sequestering carbon into the soil, the best that a synthetic like polyester can do is break neutral if they're recycling their material at a solar-powered facility. Like, when you talk about something grown from the earth, you have the ability to build biodiversity, to build the watershed, to build soil health, and that is a massive competitive advantage. And I think the hot buzzword in apparel right now is regenerative agriculture. Like, are you, you know, where are your fibers coming from? Is it regenerative or is it recycled? And I'm, you know, pushing us to regenerative because that is there's a big positive impact there.
I'd like to share a story about the microfiber thing. A couple years ago, Joe Nicosia, our boss, was about to do a speech at ICA, International Cotton Association, and he's looking for topics. And about that time, I bought a new bathing suit. You know, I can't remember what brand. So I got it. Came in the mail or Amazon or wherever I got it from, and had a little bag with it, and it said this bag is to wash it in, because it was, you know, had some polyester, and, you know, that was their way, or the polyester man-made fibers way of combating, like, the fibers getting in the water source and the fish eating them and us drinking too much beer with, you know, plastic in it. So I took it in the office, and I'm like, hey, Joe, I got a great thing for you. Use this in your speech. He's like, I love that. That's great, you know, because we're trying to, you know, promote cotton and, you know, combat the man-made fiber thing. It wasn't a big bag, and, you know, so he took it to ICA, and there's 800 or 1,000 people that go to ICA, and he held up the bag and said, does anybody know what this is? Of course, nobody did. He said, this is a bag to wash your bathing suit in. Steve Dyer gave it to me, and I was the butt of every joke because it was a small bag and I was accused of wearing a Speedo, which is not true. So it just, you know, we try, you know, as hard as we can to promote cotton. And it's hard, and I know Jesse alluded to it, you know, it's hard, and I've talked to Barry Worsham about it as well. it's hard to slander the man-made fiber world against, what we do in cotton, because we think we're better and there is some actual pollution that happens there. But we're just trying to get that message out there. I think I'm going back to the education again. You know, we've just got to tell people and get our message across. And Cotton Incorporated, CCI, everybody's doing a good job to do that. We just got to keep pushing it. We got to keep pushing the U.S. button on it. So, just more work ahead.
I think there's another aspect other than just the microfibers, and that a lot of brands and retailers are now facing pressure with respect to the end of life of their products. Those of you in the room are familiar with a brand called H&M. So H&M is a retailer out of the Netherlands or out of Holland who 2.5 years ago put boxes in their stores. Your kids, if you don't know this brand, your kids probably do know this brand. You could drop off an old used piece of clothing and get a discount on something you were buying in the store.
Levi's does this too.
Levi's does it too. So the reality is that the actual technologies for what to do with those things that are returned and post-consumer recycling. There's mechanical recycling, and now there's a lot of advent of new technologies to actually do chemical degradation of those. There's some physical limitations to the mechanical recycling that can be done. So H&M started this process, Levi's might have as well, without actually having a clear plan of what they're going to do with all the things they collected. The technologies are now catching up to it. And they're going to enable that. So the end of life is another aspect of the advantage of cotton versus a polyester. If you take a polyester t-shirt, put it in a landfill, 500 years later, it's still going to be there. You take a cotton t-shirt, especially one made with cotton thread, essentially 500 years later, it's not there anymore, obviously. So I think the end of life of products is increasingly coming under scrutiny for brands and retailers. The other aspect, which is a huge growth area, is in fact the notion of used clothing and reselling clothing that are in fact pre-owned. So there's a lot of aspects to this that go way beyond just looking at the raw material coming in and its impacts that go down the entire pathway. And cotton has a great story to tell on that front.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of good points. I really like the longevity one and the reuse. And I mean, I have a pair of jeans literally I had in high school. And they're a little beat up, but, they got character. And, a lot of the cotton things, I tend to keep longer and have a longer life. And in some ways, mechanically, it may not be stronger than a synthetic, but the character and the way I associate with it, pair of jeans. I mean, jeans, you keep them for a long time. So that's something that cotton definitely has going for it. And, of course, the biodegradability of those fibers. The cotton sheds, too, but, it's a plant. It biodegrades. And at Cotton Incorporated, we're doing a lot of research to show that cotton biodegrades and polyester actually does not. And we're really advocates for cotton in that regard and trying to make sure that polyester's impacts, the true impacts, are really known by all the brands. So maybe, Steve, on this last question here, one of the last questions at least, what do you think, you've been involved in getting BCI kind of rolled out to some producers and, that had its own challenges. What do you think about the Cotton Trust Protocol and what are some of the bigger challenges you see really getting this going over the next couple of years?
Yeah, Jesse, I think, and Ken alluded to it earlier, the board, which the three of us are on, has to make some pretty quick and I guess tough decisions on how we do the second and the third party verifications and how it works, what the percentage is. My biggest fear is that it takes off so fast that out of the, 12 or 13 million acres we're going to have in the U.S., we get 6 million acres signed up, which is a great thing. But how does myself and Frederick and a few of the big aggregators, how do we do the verifications? How do we do our second party visits? And are there enough third party guys? So that's something we're going to have to think about. We have that problem with BCI. The BCI program, you have to send people out to the farms. We have quite a few BCI farmers, so it's just a tough thing for us to do. So that's my biggest concern is can we ramp it up that fast to meet the demand? And hopefully those are always good problems, and we'll figure it out. But that's my biggest concern today.
Jesse, I thought about this question. Actually, it's a good question. And I think being a marketing person and being someone who always thinks of how are you going to tell the story behind this to start, I think reaching consumers and tapping into that demand that inherently is there in consumers. You know, one of the things, consumers are evolving. So Gen Zers and Gen Xs, you know, are the biggest consumers of farm-to-table food. So they're the ones that are most tweaked by the fact of buying something and actually from a farmer that you know, a farmer that you're able to engage with, and reducing the environmental footprint of that purchase of that food. So there's a whole generation of consumers that are looking for something to tag onto as more and more scrutiny comes around on the apparel supply chains of the world. So I think there's a great opportunity with that, but I think that's going to be one of our challenges. How do we get the message to consumers? How do we make it compelling enough for brands to want to actually put it into their messaging to consumers?
To kind of build off those answers, I think our greatest challenge is striking a balance between our stakeholder expectations. I think the world is watching. I mean, the U.S. is the third largest exporter of cotton, and so what we do is really going to it's really going to set something in motion that will last. And as a brand, we have to make sure that we're meeting, or at least compromising with the demands of our consumers and those down the supply chain, but at the same time remembering that the grower is at the center of all of this and that it has to be something that creates value for everyone and rewards those who are participating in creating that positive value. And so I've kind of covered a number of things in that one concern, but that is where I sit.
That's a terrific point. And Steve, you're quite the optimist. And like, you know, I spent a lot of time with Steven and Cotton Incorporated and Ken and Gary trying to enroll people. And you're just sitting here thinking, man, we're going to get too many growers. And I'm sitting here hearing, yeah. You know, some producers here kind of drink the Kool-Aid. They're on board. They're pretty quiet. They do it. And they're like, yes, this makes sense. And then the other ones who perhaps some of them in the room, you ask them real hard questions and real good questions that, you know, those ones stick in my mind a lot and make me feel a little unsure of how are we going to get the enrollment and really drive that value proposition and clearly articulate that and make it worth their while. So, you know, that's one concern I have.
Yeah, it is the same. It's going to take a while for everybody just to get on board. Just make it so, you know, if it's really 45 minutes to fill out the questionnaire, what's that really at the end of the day? It's not that hard. If it goes towards providing, I mean, at the end of the day, it's underlying demand and enhanced price for your product. Because like I said before, we don't want people to choose another origin. You know, we don't want them to choose Brazil. We don't want them to choose Australian. We don't want them to choose African. We want them to choose the U.S. So if this is a tool, if it's 45 minutes that every producer has to do, plus, you know, whatever kind of visit, it's really not a huge ask.
Yeah, I think each point that's made up here, the scaling in a reasonable way, making sure it connects to consumers and makes sense for brands, that we can actually articulate it and create value from it, and your point of making sure that, you know, something in it for the farmer, something in it for the supply chain, something in it for the consumer, and really safeguarding that and making sure it's fair. And then, you know, I think that kind of builds maybe one of my last points on this topic is that it's going to take everybody to make this work. It's not just going to be the growers, not going to be kind of corporate or council or brands. It needs everybody up here, the rest of the industry, you in the room, to really make this work, and we need to. Otherwise, you know, we lose our market share, polyester becomes more competitive, and we won't be here. So, you know, it's going to take all of our efforts to really push this forward.
Yeah, and just I think today polyester is cheaper than cotton. So there's a price consideration there. So again, it's talk about uphill battles. It's easy to spin. It's easily accessible. If they need more, they just turn the machine on faster. It's cheaper than cotton. They'll pretty much make sure that happens always. So we've got to stay our course.
the marketer in me is jumping in here and saying that you're never going to hear a really great story about a fourth generation polyester maker.
Probably not. Yeah.
You know, the reality with the U.S. protocol versus BCI versus any of the other protocols that have been brought to market, except potentially with the E3 from Bayer, is the foundation upon which it's built, right? So the U.S. has a structure in place, starting with the USDA, you know, USDA bail ID number and the verification process and the scrutiny under which American farmers actually do what they do, whether it's scrutiny from the US EPA, whether it's scrutiny from OSHA. No other cotton standard in the world except potentially Australia faces the same kind of scrutiny. So there's a really good solid foundation. So when this protocol starts actually aggregating data, that data is going to be much more believable and much more usable by brands and retailers and by the outside world, by investors. You know, there's a credibility factor to this that the U.S. protocol can bring that no other standard is going to be able to bring, is going to be able to touch. And it's not that far out of reach.
So at this point, you know, got through my list here. I'd like to open up to the audience. And we have an eager hand over here.
So in that, you add to a layer of cost. And as Steve mentioned, a third-party verifier just adds to the cost of this. And it's right now we're in an environment where retail is quickly changing to fast-paced Amazon.com. The malls are going away. You can see everybody changing. And I just am concerned about margins being squeezed all throughout.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm making more of a statement than asking a question, but it's a concern I have because right now, as you mentioned, Steve, polyester's 14 cents under cotton or 12 yeah. cents under cotton. Would y'all just speak to those points, please?
Yeah, I've probably been the most vocal on this and the board and through the process of the task force. A little bit, we've had the luxury to see what happened with BCI. I mean, Frederick, you've been involved, you know. There's a giant disconnect between grower to retailer and all points in between of the premiums. And a couple years ago, I was at one of the, I think it was a BCI annual meeting. I got assaulted by one of the retailers and said it was all my fault that their raw material costs have gone up. And I said, what are you talking about? They said, oh, you charge 5% upcharge for BCI. And I said, we do not. Like, absolutely. Let's just walk through it. You know, who are you talking about? You know, whatever. So come to find out, we have a cost to do BCI. We've got the third-party guys. I got my people out there and myself that are spending time to do the verifications. We got internal costs. So all we're doing is recouping a small amount of whatever it costs us. We're not trying to charge any money. The textile mill had a different message. Their message was, oh, it costs, another 5% more. And we've got to stop that in this trust protocol. We have to stop that. It has to be where I don't want a trading mechanism through the protocol. It has to be the grower's got to do it. We got to fund the protocol, and it's got to be some minimal cost to the brand and retailer. The merchant co-op community, we can't take the burden for it. And I hate to say this, but like there can't be premiums paid to producers to fill out the form. The producers have to do this for the good of the industry and to make sure that we get this thing kicked off. It's a touchy subject. I hate to bring it up, but I did. So we've got to do it to where this works for everybody. And at the end of the day, we can fund the protocol. We can fund the third-party verifications. We can do everything that we can do, and everybody's happy. That's my perspective on it today.
I think just adding to that point, I mean, obviously BCI did end up in the marketplace actually costing a premium. There was basically premiums charged. And I always use the analogy of a hose. You have a nice garden hose, the water's flowing through and everything's perfect. If you put a small kink in that hose, the pressure goes up. If you put two kinks in the hose, the pressure continues to go up. So every one of the stages in the supply chain is a kink in the hose. Human greed has the opportunity for textile mills to basically say, well, I'm having to segregate this inside my plant, so I'm going to basically charge a premium. Or I'm having to segregate it amongst my purchasing, so I'm going to charge a premium. The reality is that if all you're doing at the end of the day is selling a pound of cotton versus all the other pounds of cotton that are sold in the world, and there's no difference to the retailer, then you would not be able to charge more. The retailers are coming to you, and the brands and retailers are coming to you and saying, I want sustainable cotton. A lot of them have made very, very strong, very public statements about buying sustainable cotton. They know that that's not going to come at zero premium. They might want to pressure the industry. The reality is that it's built into their models that it will probably come at a slight premium. The speed at which we can actually get growers signed in and the speed at which we can actually get critical mass to this is going to help actually reduce that premium and reduce the kind of pain points that happen along the way or the kinks in that hose.
I don't think I have too much more to add to that. I mean, with BCI scale, we are able to see kind of what happens and that scale can drive costs down, but it's still, you know, you have players that take advantage of the system, and so now we've learned and are working to control for that. But I think I would add, you know, we're seeing it as a brand globally, different government interventions getting involved and costs rising for all brands who want to sell or want to manufacture in different countries. The EU is, I mean, across the board, and I think it's important to remember, you know, it's not just cotton, it's everything is being touched. We're getting taxed for carbon emissions. We're, you know, it's a lot of different things. Our packaging, which if you look at our total environmental footprint, it's really not much with the hang tag, but we have to report that now to every government in the EU, how much paper and plastic waste we're generating. And so there are costs that we're incurring across the board, and just That's the reality of it. Sustainability is something we're now having to budget for.
Noted. Great answers. Back here.
One quick comment. I really appreciate everything you guys have come and done. I've been really thrilled with this whole trust protocol. I think it answers potentially all sorts of questions. What I found disconcerting over the last 8-9 months, the producers and ag people that I've talked to who are really plugged in seem to be real hesitant about it. And so it maybe shows part of that educational gap that's going to happen, because I've talked with producers and said, well, certainly you're signed up for that. And they go, nope. And not because they didn't know it existed, but said, I went in, looked at it, talked with people, didn't get the answers I wanted, and they haven't done it yet. So I think that educational stuff, I don't know how it goes. You probably made a good stab at that today. But I've been surprised at the people who haven't jumped on it.
That's a great point, and I can I'm directly working with some of that. In this pilot year, we were getting things in order and really refining our message, and we had some guinea pigs, and they gave us some real good feedback and sometimes didn't join, and you know, that's what we wanted. We also wanted them to join. Sometimes they didn't, but that told us what we needed to do and refine our message, and we've done so. We worked at the marketing agencies to really get a clearer message, which Ken did a good job showing earlier with that video and other things. But we have a big push this coming year to increase awareness, really socialize this, and educate the importance of why this is really needed. Because, you know, me just showing up, you know, from one person from North Carolina, that ain't going to work. They need to hear it from everybody across the supply chain, all these different channels, different media outlets. It needs to kind of surround them so that they can become aware of it and better join. But glad to open the floor on that one, too.
Well, I think it's really important to, and I think it was Jeff earlier in the panel who talked about context. So essentially when you're speaking to growers, speaking language that growers are going to understand, but it's also about brands and retailers speaking the language that they're going to understand. Government agencies, you know, there's government agencies in the EU that don't recognize U.S. cotton as being sustainable cotton. It's having conversations with those agencies and saying and explaining to them in their language exactly what it is that makes U.S. cotton sustainable. So I think the messaging, and there's a lot of I's to dot and T's to cross in the protocol. Again, I think the encouraging part for me as an outsider coming into this and being involved in this is very much the solid foundation upon which it's built. And Ken and Gary and the guys at the SEAM have built a really solid platform. So the actual technology platform itself is capturing all of this data well beyond what is potentially usable right now today with the technologies we have, but it's essentially there. So it's captured, it's safe, it's secure, and it's credible, which I think is a really, really important part from the very beginning. But as you know, has been said, there's a lot of work still left to do.
I would say I think the brands and retailers have a role to play in that educational piece too. I mean, with the growers that I do get the opportunity to speak to are like, oh, okay, so you're interested in this. Like, your consumers are asking for this. And so having those dialogues and helping to demonstrate the value proposition, I think it seems to be helpful in my experience. And I don't know, getting opportunities to come here and meet with everybody from the parts of our supply chain that I don't get to see at the apparel conferences is really, I'm hoping, is helpful.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry. Yeah.
Steve,
yeah.
This question is for you since you're part of the supply chain. Probably can answer it, but I asked a question earlier because I don't think you're going to get every U.S. grower. So I'm wondering at what point do you have enough growers where you can know your grower? I mean, do you have some idea what it's going to take you and how long it is to be?
Well, sort of. There's a lot of people in the world that have drank the BCI Kool-Aid. And it's going to be hard to get them off of it. There's a lot that haven't, and there's a lot that are willing to adapt the protocol. The big question we have now is the credit system versus traceability. You know, does the world move to a traceable system where they want the actual bales? And then Gary and I have had 1,000 conversations about, and he's exactly right. He's like, that's great. It goes to my textile mill. You've documented it. Everything's great. And then it hits the textile mill, and I can't trace anything from there. So does it matter? but as far as the credit system or the mass balance, we call it, goes, yeah, I'm not too concerned about that. I think if the, and from my perspective, if the global brand and retail community will accept the mass balance system, then I think we'll be good. I think there'll be a period of time, you know, the honeymoon phase where people are adopting the protocol. As far as percent that we need, we know we're not going to get every U.S. grower to do this. What's critical mass? Tough. I mean, the U.S. textile mills should adapt it, and that's a little over 3 million bales, call it 3.1, 3.2 million bales. You know, we export, you know, with some good luck, about 16 million. So that's about a 19 million bale, demand pool. You know, we need a quarter of that to get scale. And that's rough numbers, but that's my opinion.
Laurie, do we have time for one more?
If there was a quarter, you'd think the story to be told. Yep. We can answer this for the world.
I believe so. Yep.
And I, you're going to have more.
Yeah, sorry, and I was just going to add, and don't negate the fact that there'll be a halo effect on the rest of U.S. cotton, right? So
yeah.
You'll
great
specifically
point.
Have identifiable
yeah.
protocol cotton, but that will have a cascading halo effect on the way the rest of the world views U.S. cotton in general. And the only other comment I was just going to add was that, you know, the era and the pressures that brands and retailers faced and the marketplace faced when BCI was brought to market are very different than what the brands and retailers are facing today. Back at that era, investors were asking, do you put out a report? Now they're asking 32 different questions with specific metrics, and they're asking for data. And BCI can never provide that data, so this protocol has the opportunity to provide that data. So I would very much view this as being an enabler and something that's going to allow brands and retailers and help them to, in fact, tell their story.
And I think we have to kind of wrap it up in light of the time. We took 5 minutes of your break, but great questions from the audience. Thank you so much. I think we'll be around after this, gladly entertain some good conversations. But I'd like to thank everyone up on stage, your leaders within your field. Also, your companies are quite done a lot of great work in all this. So thank you for your leadership and the board, as well as really showing up here today and doing what you do. Thank you.